this is a case study in not only bureaucracy run amok, but bureaucracy weaponized against particularly the farming community here in Washington State. I mean, I think people often think, well, you know, regulators are regulators and, you know, everybody has lots of rules to follow, yada, yada. This clearly demonstrates agriculture, farming in Washington State being singled out and treated differently basically than everybody else. What am I talking about? I'm talking about what is, in my view, the Washington State Department of Labor and Industry's absolute mishandling of protecting farm workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. Welcome back to the Farming Show. I'm Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI News Talk 790. Glad you're here with us on a Saturday morning, and glad that we are inching our way back toward a more normal world. Everybody happy about that? I know all of this has been crazy, and we could go on and on, I'm sure, for hours about all of the insanity that has ensued, but particularly this issue of keeping farm workers safe. It's an important thing during the pandemic. We talked a lot about it, though. At the same time, crops needed to come in, things needed to happen, work needed to get done. Farming and the farming community, essential work, as labeled by our federal government. I think that's pretty obvious. We all need to eat. And we covered it pretty in depth here on the program last year at about this time when we were talking about bunk bed bans and questions about, you know, what science were any of the state's rules on farms and farm workers to purportedly protect them from the COVID-19 virus. Well, the story has just continued with more and more twists and turns. Joining me right now with WAFLA, Dan Fazio, their executive director. Dan, welcome to the program this morning. I mean, if we thought last, you know, spring and summer was kind of crazy, well, even though the pandemic seems to be winding down, if I can position it that way, the craziness with our bureaucrats and our state leaders doesn't seem to be waning with the things that they've been up to. Explain what happened as, you know, the science started to change, people started to get vaccinated, and the state singled out farming to say, no, we're going to keep the strict rules on you, but not on everybody else.
Hey, Dylan. Great to be back. Love your show. Hey, a little bit cooler weather down here in Olympia this morning. Maybe you might get a little bit of rain out of our parts, but great to be back with you, and a big fan of your show. Yeah, this turned away from best science and into worst politics in a very, very short order. So that's kind of what happened. Again, you stated it correctly. You know, farmers need to have a safe workplace, and they're all about workplace safety. But we're not a shoe factory that you can, you know, close the door, turn the lock, and close it up, and lock it up, and come back a year later, and then start rolling out shoes. So people had to do work, and we had to keep workers safe. And the program that we work with is the legal worker program, and all the farmers that have labor-intensive agriculture and house workers and have in housing that's inspected by the feds and the state. It quickly turned into let's forget about the best science and let's have the politics away from allowing us to use the legal worker program, because people down here in Olympia don't like legal worker programs, which is bizarre in and of itself. But that's kind of where we're at. So we went, you know, from best science to politics pretty quickly. And luckily, we were able to, with some good public relations and a little help with a lawsuit, And really, the people in the agency standing up to their political bosses and saying, hey, we can't enforce these regulations. They're ridiculous. I'll cite one in particular where they said if a person had symptoms of COVID, they had to be isolated. Great. Have to give them 3 meals a day. Great. But then they said, well, you have to have a doctor or a medical provider come and make a house call on this person twice a day. And we said, well, wait a minute. No one in America gets twice a day house calls. I'm 65 years old. I've never had a house call by a doctor in my life, Dylan. And I seem to be doing okay.
I think my grandpa is the only one who I've ever heard talk about that.
Well, Dylan, I mentioned this to my family doctor, and she said, you know, to me, Dan, if you got COVID today, I would, you know, assess you and see how bad you were. And if, you know, if I didn't have to admit you to the hospital, I'd have you go home and relax. And, you know, maybe you might get a bottle of oxygen or something like that prescribed to you. And I would tell you to call us if your condition worsens. But she said, I've never heard of anyone prescribing the treatment for COVID as having someone come and physically come and take your, you know, your vitals at 10 a.m. and then at 4 p.m. every day. But that's what we had to do in agriculture. And there were many, many other examples of just not feasible and dumb stuff that they were having us do. And you know, thanks to publicity, some articles in newspapers, people even in Seattle calling up and saying, this is ridiculous. What are you doing this to farmers? And kind of exposed that it was a kind of a political thing rather than, you know, anything that had to do with best science.
Well, that's exactly right. We see more and more and more of this where back to something you talked about the bureaucracy. So did I at the beginning here. I think this is, like I said, bureaucracy run amok and bureaucracy weaponized, in this case, against the farming community. My gut tells me that this is really exposing some of the political machinations and ulterior motives that probably already existed. And you know the saying, never let a good crisis go to waste. There we were at a time when we needed to be protecting people. We still need to protect people. But that's not what these folks really actually had in mind. They were trying to accomplish other things as a result of the crisis that we were in. They were trying to pull political levers and then shame people into having to follow it. Well, not just shame, but also legally and financially coerce them into having to do these things that didn't make sense, weren't supported by science, but would achieve a political end for, like you said, the powers that be.
Can I give you a couple of statistics, Dylan?
Go for it.
So first of all, you know, we said, hey, wait a minute, this is not best science. The CDC came up here and they found that at the height of the pandemic, you know, in the harvest last year, a person living in one of these inspected temporary worker housing facilities that the state was trying to shut down or reduce the capacity by 50%, the CDC said a worker is three times safer, three times less likely to contract the COVID virus living in these congregate housing facilities that were run by the farmers than they were living in the local community in the small communities in central Washington. So that came out in, you know, that study happened in late August, was when they did the sampling in the communities and then at the housing facilities. And then what the farmers did in November and December said, look, what we're going to do is we're going to test every worker that comes up here on arrival, okay? And then as soon as they get a negative test, we're going to quarantine them until we can get them vaccinated. So guess what? Between January and April, okay, we tested 8,500 people, or 8,500 workers arrived. We contracted with a nonprofit that had mobile testing, and 100% of them were tested. And then from that point on, we've had 98% vaccination rates of the workers coming from Mexico with a visa in the temporary worker housing. So we're getting really 100% vaccination rates, less than 0.5% positives. If the people are positive, we immediately isolate them, and you know the workers are paid during their isolation. And then what happens is, as soon as we can, we vaccinate the people, and it's usually within a couple of days of arrival. We get a negative test within 24 hours of arrival, and then we vaccinate. So we're at in these facilities where we've done everything the government has asked and more, and we say, hey, what's the off ramp? What do we do?
Yeah.
People are in facilities where 100% of the people in the facility are vaccinated, and they were still saying employers have to enforce masking and social distancing and plastic barriers between sinks and all these other things when we had 100% vaccinations, if you can believe that.
Well, I mean, if you look at all these ridiculous rules that you're listing, and what jogged my memory was that your mention of folks coming in, being tested immediately, and then being quarantined even though they tested negative. Dan, I don't know, and we're talking with Dan Fazio with WAFLA right now, farm labor organization here in Washington State, and they do some outside of Washington as well, but mostly here. Dan, I don't know if you've followed what's been going on to our north up in Canada, but to me, all of this sounds like the LNI is being run by Justin Trudeau, for crying out loud, because they have so much nonsensical stuff up there as well. This falls, in my mind, right into that category, but in a lot of ways, well, I don't know what the whole game is up there because I don't follow Canadian politics enough, but here in Washington, certainly, I think the motivations behind some of these things are likely a lot more nefarious. If we go back to the very beginning of this, before the state had issued specific rules for farm workers, farms were already scrambling to protect workers because, for crying out loud, they want to keep them safe, not only because it's the right thing to do, and these are humans who have dignity and they're respected, but also because why would you want your workforce to suddenly all get sick? It doesn't make sense. It's something that no one would want. Nothing gets done then. So, of course, people were scrambling, but at the same time, we had labor activists screaming that people weren't being protected, that the situation was out of control, it was a total mess, people were deliberately being put in harm's way, and then we see a state government and a state bureaucracy react to that noise, not listening to reality, not listening to science, but reacting to that political noise and doing a lot of things in response that were even more ridiculous. Again, back to the bunk bed ban and all of that. As we pointed out at the time, the bunk bed ban actually putting a lot more people at risk of COVID than if that would have happened,
right,
than actually allowing them to stay in approved housing. But
right,
like you say, right, Dan, and this is a farming show, by the way, Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI with Dan WAFLA Dan Fazio from WAFLA. Dan, like you said, the vaccine was rolled out, more people got vaccinated, incredibly high rates within the farm worker community, farm workers coming here to work, and we roll into spring now, and the state, as it backed off the restrictions on everybody else, which was kind of a surprise, I think, to some, when all of a sudden our governor, Jay Inslee, comes out and says, okay, well, we're going to, we can start, and CDC guidance too, I guess, pushed him, but, masks
right,
aren't such a big thing. We're pulling back from some of this lockdown stuff, but not for farming. Explain specifically what happened there.
Well, yeah, and it's a good transition into what you were talking about with activists, and a transition into what they're doing now with hiring 30 new outreach workers between two agencies to kind of look over people's shoulder. What happened was that the folks from LNI called us up and said, well, we had to do these regulations because the farm worker advocate industry is, getting press, and we don't want to have good press, bad press, and so we're going to do more regulations. And so what you guys have to do is stop talking to us about best science and start going and get articles in the press. And we're like, if that's what it takes, that's what we'll do. But the last time we checked, we thought you guys were supposed to look at best science, and that's really where what happened. And so, we said to, Governor Inslee, look, we want to do the right thing. We want to be at the table. We want to ask what it is that gets us on the off-ramp, off of these silly, rules, and quite frankly, you know, we're just doing what we can to protect our workforce. And then once our workforce is protected and we feel good about that, then we do what we can to not get fined, right? And so so they said, look, you know, we'll back off when the publicity tells us to back off. And that's kind of what happened. And now they're telling us they're going to have to hire a lot more inspectors, so that when the farm worker advocate industry makes these claims, which they're telling us are all bogus, that they have the data to push back on them. And that's kind of what they're telling us. They've got to spend millions and millions of dollars of tax dollars to have people just wandering around the farms, so that when the advocates call them up, they can say, okay, we have a guy there, and it's not true. So it's, you know, it's kind of like you get accused of something, and it's not, you know, innocent until proven guilty. It's guilty until proven innocent. Yep. And that's kind of where what it's devolved to over here.
And that's how our state bureaucracy operates. And people in so many different walks of life and sectors of our economy have experienced this. It's rampant, certainly, in the farming community and the world of farming here in Washington, because for whatever, you know, a variety of reasons that we talk about a lot on this show, it's in vogue right now to go after these issues in farming. It's somehow socially acceptable for these groups to continue to parade false claim after false claim out in public and create this perception that things are just terrible on farms for farmers and farm workers in particular, when none of it is backed up. That's the thing right now. Just a week or two ago, Familias Unidas por la Justicia, the farm worker union, activist union, you know, Ramon Torres, Edgar Franks, Rosalinda Guillen and company, in a post on Facebook said, we already know that employers want everyone working under the same conditions where thousands of us get sick. Well, it defies all logic. It certainly is the opposite of the truth, but it defies even basic logic. Yet these people continue now, well over a year later, to push this false, backward, 180-degree backward narrative.
I'm sorry to disappoint those folks, but the workers are not getting sick. And we're doing the right thing. I'm also sorry to disappoint your listeners that they're taking taxpayer dollars out of our unemployment insurance trust account. $3.5 million were taken out in this legislative session to fund 14 outreach workers for the Employment Securities Department. This is an unemployment insurance trust fund where money was supposed to be going to people that were unemployed, and a lot of those people didn't get their money, but they've got money to take out to have outreach workers to wander around the farms. $3.5 million there, and then $4.5 million taken out of the workers' compensation trust fund. So if you get hurt at work, you're supposed to have money to pay for your treatment and your disability pay. $4.5 million out of that to fund outreach workers, and then more inspectors for agriculture, so that when the folks you mentioned call up and say that we need more inspections, they've got plenty of inspectors sitting there waiting for their beck and call. By the way, the folks from the Employment Securities Department, Outreach Department, needed the $3.5 million more because they had 12 people in this unit, and in the last 2 years, they've done exactly one inspection. So I guess if we give them $3.5 million more, maybe they can increase by 100% the number of inspections they do. We're not, you know, particularly concerned about the inspections because the farmers are doing things right. It's just, you know, the waste of taxpayer money that should be going to other things.
And it's a big game. Just inspect, intimidate via those inspections, and then just wait around for any little thing, blow it way out of proportion. This is the same game that's been played over and over, and here they're doing it again, not letting a good crisis go to waste. And they're essentially, in my view, taking this money, like you said, money that's supposed to be helping the unemployed, and even worse, in my mind, money that's supposed to be going to injured workers workers, people who are actually, you know, have actually dealt with some hardship, to go try to find something that isn't there, and really ultimately play a political game with that money.
And these organizations are getting grants from Washington, D.C. right now. The grant spigots are on, and their livelihood depends on them saying that farm workers were abused. And that's kind of why we get these allegations, that, you know, they make the allegations, and then so we have to spend government money from your income taxes to fund these people to make these allegations, and then we have to take money out of the workers' compensation trust funds and the unemployment insurance trust funds to fund people to go tell the people, well, we went out there and checked on, you know, your allegation, and it wasn't, you know, we weren't able to sustain it, and then they have another hissy fit at when we go to these meetings, because they say that, you know, then they say the departments are in the hip pocket of the farmers.
It's unbelievable.
It's tough. We did want to give a shout out to some of the people at LNI though, who finally stood up to their political bosses and said, hey, enough is enough. We got to get back to best science. We're going to lose credibility with the regulated community, and we're losing credibility with the public at large when we have these crazy regulations that don't make any sense, when we know that people want the off ramp, they want, you know, to get back to normal, and that's what our job is, and not just to tell people to be fear mongers.
Exactly right. Dan Fazio with WAFLA here on The Farming Show. I'm Dylan Honkoop. Thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate it. And I guess we just, that last little bit that you said about folks within the organization, I guess preserves at least a little shred of faith in humanity for me. So we'll hope that portion of our society and those in positions of influence continue to go in that direction and not the other direction. Dan, thanks for your time this morning.
Perfect. And we'll end on a good note. Thanks so much for everything that you do, Dylan.
Keeping our water clean, it's an important thing for everybody in our community. Everybody plays a role in it. We've talked about it so many times here on the program. Certainly the farming community plays a role in keeping water clean. So how is our water doing? You know, we've been talking about other stuff a lot lately on the program. We used to talk about water quality a lot more. Some of those issues were in the news, and they were controversial, and there were things going on in the courts and with politics. But where are we at now? It's something we cannot take for granted. And just because there isn't a controversial moment happening doesn't mean we don't need to stay on top of what's going on. What can the farming community be doing? What are they doing? What are other parts of our communities doing here in Whatcom County and certainly beyond as well? Welcome back to The Farming Show. Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI News Talk 790. Glad to be with you here on your Saturday morning. Joining me right now is the chair of the Portage Bay Shellfish Advisory Committee and a longtime expert involved in local water quality issues in Whatcom and Skagit counties and beyond, Christine Woodward. Welcome to the program this morning. Very glad that you could be with us to share some of your expertise and some of the history here locally. First, I mean, just from your title there, we should talk about, you know, it was in the news. It was a point of controversy. It was a point of an historic agreement, ultimately, that was part of things changing. What are the current situation, you know, details in Portage Bay right now and shellfish, you know, such a focus to get that back open and get that shellfish clean, the water clean and harvestable.
Thank you, Dylan, and thank you all the listeners out there that you are concerned about our water quality in Portage Bay and in Drayton Harbor. Really appreciate that. Portage Bay, of course, is the end of the Nooksack River watershed, and Drayton Harbor is fed by California and Dakota Creek.
So how are the shellfish doing? How's the water quality doing in both of those?
Well, I think we've had some challenges in both those locations. Lots of great work being done, but we still just have these uncontrolled moments of weather and large rainfalls that have just really been hard to keep our water quality up, even with all the good work that's being done.
Well, let's give some background on that then. Explain what has all been done in the last, I mean, you've been at this for 30 plus years, but I guess maybe more recently, what, you know, the last 5, 10, 15 years, what's been going on to try to turn this around?
Oh my gosh, there's just been so much countywide for educational programs and stewardship programs and on-site septic system agreements and farmers and hobby farmers and berry farmers and everybody who works or lives in the watersheds. It's just been a concerted effort to try to really make everybody be accountable. It's not just one person that's the cause of poor water quality. It's just a myriad, and with Nooksack especially being such a huge watershed, we've been doing well over the years, and we've really been keeping our bacteria levels at a good manageable. I wouldn't say manageable, because is bacteria ever manageable? But all the work that's been done in the county has really been paying off. And gosh, you know, we've just had these incredible rainstorms that have really kind of pushed us back a bit. So one thing that we're not in control of course, is the weather. But, you know, what can we as a community do better to keep our water clean? That's what the advisory committee really tries to work on with the county, and we're the advisory committee to Whatcom County Council. So we don't really make the big decisions, but we with the different organizations that are involved with our shellfish districts, that's the information that moves on to County Council, so they know how we're doing and what we're doing. Whatcom County really has been doing a great job overall, but we can't give up. We can't let it slide. That is what happened before. We got Portage open before the shellfish beds, and then, you know, we let up the gas a little bit, and here we are back again.
So that was just in terms of a rough timeline. I know things were not good, say, back in the mid-90s. It was after that things improved, and then it was what, in the mid-2000s, where it went downhill again, and now it is kind of, you know, improved again, this kind of up and down as things change.
It does feel like a bit of a yo-yo, Dylan. It really does. And again, you know, we can't control the weather, but we can just try to get everybody on board, working the best that we can to put our best practices forward.
So what was, and by the way, again, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Christine Woodward. She is the chair of the Portage Bay Shellfish Advisory Committee. We're talking about water quality, particularly in Portage Bay, and she also keeps an eye on what's going on in Drayton Harbor. And of course, you know, this is all part of the Nooksack River and the Nooksack River watershed. So I'm sure you're following stuff from, data that's always coming in from various points across the whole watershed and beyond. What was done in those periods of improvement? I'm interested in that, because I think that's what we need to be focused on. And let's learn those lessons. Let's not forget those, and let's keep doing those things that was able to now a couple of different times make a marked change.
Right. Well, I think, Dylan, it really boils down to being good stewards, no matter if you have a septic system that is linked somewhere into the watershed, if you have a hobby farm, if you have dogs, it's keeping your area so there's no runoff into either one of the watersheds for Drayton Harbor and Nooksack. It really is all about being a good steward and being aware of what you have, what your property has, you know, moving your animals around so they're not having a negative impact on the watershed, on water that runs off your property.
What do you know about what farmers can be doing right now to make sure to stay on top of what they're doing? What was it that farmers did in those periods of improvement that helped turn things around? Because I know they were involved in that, and people had to, in many different cases, change what they were doing or take a different approach.
Well, I would like to be able to answer for the farmers, but I think the farmers have a better answer than I do.
Yeah.
Because there was a very concentrated effort, and all the farmers, majority of the farmers, stepped up to the plate and really, roof gutters, manure lagoons, mm-hmm. spreading liquid manure in the wintertime. There were just all these things that the farmers did, and it really made a lot of difference. But it was also the fact that we started looking at on-site septic systems and weren't really pointing the finger at any one organization.
Yeah.
It was everybody that had to be accountable. And that was difficult at times to get people to understand that they're all responsible.
Yeah, and I know the farming community in particular, had many moments of great frustration, feeling like, there was a bullseye on their back. They were targeted. They were blamed for the whole thing, when that wasn't always the case. So, changing that to a collaborative approach where, okay, we're all in this together, we're all going to work together, and we're going to turn this around, recognizing that it's not just one or the other. I know from my side, from the farming community side, that was really important. It's a trust building thing, right?
It really is. And it's just making sure that that's the way it is, that everybody is accountable. It's not pointing the finger at your fellow down the road. It's taking a look at what you have and making sure, what you have is clean. Because we all know everybody lives downstream and everybody relies on clean water. And at the end, it's the shellfish that are the indicators of what's going on in the upper watershed.
They are the canaries in our watershed coal mine, right?
Yes, they are. Yep.
So, we can talk about, it is important to maintain shellfish harvest. Those folks are really, in a lot of ways, farming just like on land farmers are. There's that, question about equity and also heritage and mm-hmm. rights and all of those things. But really, even beyond just the shellfish, they are in some ways just an indicator, not to minimize their importance, but they're an indicator of a problem that's probably affecting a lot of other things, right? What poor water quality, what does it all affect, at least from your vantage point? What things do you look to?
Well, poor water quality means that if you're watering animals downstream and you have poor water quality upstream, there's opportunity there for your animals to not be well. It's children that are playing in our creeks and streams and rivers in the summertime or in the springtime. It's everybody who has contact with that water, any animal that has contact with that water. I mean, that's an opportunity for them to be ill, and nobody wants that.
Well, and we've heard a lot recently about salmon and water quality, and that's focused, I think, mostly on toxins. And, most recently, there have been some more clarification of the data and work that they're doing, tire dust being a big culprit, tire dust from our roads ending up mm-hmm. by one way or the other in our streams, and that's killing fish. When we're talking about water quality and farming and shellfish, that's, as you've been alluding to, that's much more focused on bacteria.
Stormwater is a huge issue. So many pollutants in our stormwater.
So what into the future? It sounds like we can learn from our past that working together is so important rather than pointing fingers when things just don't get done. You're saying that it can be done, that you've seen it happen. I know there's still a lot of people skeptical about that approach generally, and not just with water quality, but with so many other issues that we've been talking about and have been more kind of front burner lately. You're saying it is doable for all these diverse players, really stakeholders in our water and water quality in our whole community. It is possible to work together, because people are skeptical of that.
people, yes. I'm just going to say yes, because we've done it in the past. Mm-hmm. It's getting everybody on board. It's making sure everybody's being held accountable. I'm accountable. You're accountable. The guy up the road, the guy down the road.
Yeah.
Everybody just has to be accountable and do everything that they can to make sure that we all respect clean water and that we all deserve it. And when you get down to our farmers of the tide flats, they deserve to be able to have a healthy crop that they can manage too.
Mm-hmm. What are the ingredients needed for that kind of collaboration though? I know we touched on trust a little bit earlier. That's a huge one, right?
Mm-hmm. I think trust and understanding and respect.
Yeah.
It's not holding one organization more important than another, but it's holding all the associations and organizations accountable for their actions.
Well, this is a good message to hear, because I know for anybody, and again, not to point fingers, you know, whether it's farmers or people with dogs or, you know, mm-hmm. hobby farmers or cities or anybody, you know, when we do have periods of success, and this goes for anything, you know, on something that we're trying to turn around as a society, as a community, things get better. It is very easy then to let down your guard. Right? And let things slide and say, oh, is it really that important that we do X extra thing, you know, fill in the blank, to, you know, everything's going fine. It'll be, you know, is that kind of the danger here, where people just kind of let it slide and forget how crucial each little step that everybody is doing is to the whole?
It's always tough. You know, it's always tough to keep doing the right thing. But, my mom always told me, when you point the finger at somebody else, there's fingers pointing back at you. So only you can be accountable for what you do.
Yeah. How did you get into all of this? Where did you get started in this world of water quality here locally?
I had some really good teachers at Western. Hmm. And when I first started out, this was not where I was headed in my educational career. But I had a couple of wonderful professors that got me hooked. Mm. And I was able to get a job, very fortunate to be able to stay in Bellingham, to get a job right out of university. And that was it. I got hooked on water, and that's where I've been my entire career.
How much different would you say the whole situation between collaboration and the actual data on how water quality is doing? How much is that different since that time?
Oh my gosh. Just the type of information that we have now to be able to make critical decisions has changed so much over the years. I remember going out in my first job down on the Stillaguamish River, and I didn't have a lab. I had a piece of equipment that measured pH and conductivity, and I had my little bottles that I'd be out taking samples and had to send them off to the lab. And yeah, now it's, holy cow, quicker information, more sophisticated lab work, and being able to really narrow down better information.
Are we in a better place? Or I guess we, is water quality itself in a better place now over that amount of time?
I think we know more. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that makes it easier, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think we're doing a real good job. Mm. There's always room for improvement.
I think the public is getting a taste of that. You know, how much you know affects what's going on with this whole pandemic, and, you know, testing, and how accurate is the testing, and how do positives relate to actual cases that actually relate to significant health impacts. You know, I think the public is getting a taste of what you've been experiencing in this water quality realm for decades now, just based on technology and what you know. So I that makes more sense to me than it would have a year ago. If there is anything positive to come out of this COVID thing, at least my understanding of, you know, how fraught the science can be when it hits the public sphere has certainly changed because of all of that.
Mm-hmm. And again, if we all just do all we can to make it better, then it's going to happen.
Well, that's encouraging, and let's keep it up. And it's encouraging that we have been able to make successes over the years, but a good reminder, too, that we can't let down our guard. Again, Christine Woodward, Chair of the Portage Bay Shellfish Advisory Committee. Thanks for your time chatting with us here on The Farming Show this morning.
Thank you, Dylan, and thank you to all the listeners out there.